It'll sit here and wait for banking. Like last one.
Is he bloody late again?
No, he's so late. 2 weeks late.
He's going to love hearing the B-roll on this.
Welcome to GCP Bytes, episode number 14 for Friday, the 11th of April, 2025. GCP Bytes is a podcast where we discuss Google Cloud and tech. And I'm your temporary host for this fortnight, Dave Wall. And on today's show, Broadcom is tightening the screws again. Did Oracle Cloud get breached? And what awesome things have they announced at Google next? But before we get to any of that, I'd like to introduce my co-host and resident GDE, Ian Brown. How you doing, Ian?
I'm good, mate. How you doing?
You know what? I'm here. That took like four attempts to record the intro.
That took a couple of goes, but you know, it just goes to show how hard it is to actually record just a whole segment there. The banky just rolls off every time.
Yeah, he's done a few attempts himself. We've sat here in the B-roll plenty of times. So for everybody listening, Banky is having a well-deserved holiday this fortnight. And so I'm in the big chair today, and Ian's taken on my big chair.
And his own big chair.
We've got a little empty chair. That's
so the GDA chair sitting in the corner.
Yeah. So this is going to be, this is us for the fortnight. It's a big, big fortnight, like especially the amount of stuff that's come out today.
it's massive. Because we're recording this on Thursday morning, and of course that's Wednesday night over in the US, and Next has just kicked off. So it is like just stuff dropping constantly. The Slack, I've had to close Slack down because it just pings me all the time with the new announcement. So, you know, this will be effective as of Thursday morning.
Yeah, well, exactly right. And so, you know, this podcast will go live tomorrow, our time, so Friday. So a lot of this stuff will still be sort of fleshing out into, across LinkedIn.
Yeah.
Like the keynote was only just like 3 hours ago.
Yeah, that's like right. Yeah. So I saw a notification of it, and I got the email from the GDE community about all the releases that would come out. So we're going to share some of them. That was under an NDA until sort of this morning when I got the email. So yay, we get to share it just in the nick of time.
Yeah, and see, for me, because I can't have any of that, I'm not bound by the NDA. So I'm like, okay, what has become publicly available? All right, cool. I have to read this before we actually record.
Yeah. But how crazy is what's going on at the moment? Like, I read a post this morning that the president of the US has raised the tariffs to China to 135%, I think it was.
Yeah.
It was some insane amount of percentage.
Yeah, and so like every day that goes past now, we get some arbitrary number is added to theirs. By the end of the day, then China comes back, and because I think as of yesterday, I think last night when I went to bed, China had just put theirs up to 84% on the counter tariffs. But you know what the big one is, right? So tariffs is one thing. China has instructed their banks to stop buying US bonds.
Ooh, ouch. All right, I didn't see that one.
Yeah, so the 10-year bond yield was up at nearly, I think it hit like 5% last night. So that's people not wanting to bankroll the US. Because they don't have a central bank anymore, do they?
They don't have a central bank like we've got the RBA as our central bank.
They do have the Fed.
Oh, okay.
This is basically the US debt is all bankrolled.
Right.
So it's a challenging time for lots of people. I mean, like I've got a manufacturing business. I ship worldwide, so I have to be across a bunch of these things. But what kind of plans can you make when, tariffs turn on a dime? Are they in? Are they not?
That's right. And I see another post I saw said that there's lots of other countries that their tariffs are going down to 10%, which is roughly in line of what we charge the US to bring stuff into Australia.
Okay. So that's not quite true, right? We got a free trade agreement with the US, right? So we don't charge the US any tariffs. The only thing that applies is GST, right?
Yeah.
So, but that's not a US thing. Like, we charge it against our own products. Like, it is,
we charge against everything. Basically,
it's a sales tax.
That's not a natural good. Like fruit and veg and milk and that sort of stuff.
Correct. So there's not an actual tariff where we're like, hey, well, if you want to ship us steel, you know, you have to get this extra 10% thing and GST. No, the GST is a level playing field.
Yeah.
And it's the same with the VAT in Europe. Like, I think the VAT, because like when I ship to Europe, right, my customers have to pay that when they get it. And it's like, it's like 24%.
Wow. Right.
So because I'm not in Europe and like the UK, so I don't have a registered office there. I don't have a UK VAT number. I can't take those taxes for them. So they have to do it on the receiving side.
Right. And saying, whereas we're imposing in Australia that every company that sells to Australia must collect those taxes for us.
Yeah, yes and no. Like, there's two different ways. So like services, you know, I'll give you an example. My Google subscription, right? Mm-hmm. Like my Google Workspace one for the business, right?
Yep.
Pays GST. Google's in Australia. They're registered in Australia. I pay in Australian dollars. They collect the GST. I get that back as a business owner because I have input credits of GST and, you know, it's all kind of boring, but it fleshes out in the end. But other services that I use that are US-based, even if I maybe pay in Australian dollars, they're not registered for GST and don't collect it.
Right, okay.
Right, so like my shipping solution. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So I don't pay it on that one.
Like, okay. I always thought that there was because that was something that Jared Harvey was screaming poor about years ago about, you know, all these companies over in the overseas, like China and the US and all that are selling to Australians, and they're not paying GST and we've got to charge GST. So
yeah, well, it certainly was the case, right? So if I buy anything, you buy like a $500 thing. Oh yeah, I bought that that B-Link PC a little while ago, but it was less than $1,000, right? It was less than $1,000. I didn't have to pay GST. There's no so I paid it in their currency, including the shipping costs. It comes through Border Force here in Australia. It's less than $1,000, doesn't accrue GST. But if I buy a 3D printer, which is about $1,500, it comes in, it hits customs. Customs assesses that not only do I have to pay duty on it, but then you also pay like an $80 like assessment fee.
Right. Wow.
All right, which, yeah. So, and then again, business-wise, I get the GST part of that back, but I don't get the assessment fee back.
But you don't get the assessment fee back and, Okay, yeah, there you go. Quick and dirty tutorial on how GST actually works in this country, because I haven't really bothered to look. I just play it.
it's a thrilling topic and it's very interesting for our listeners.
Said, no one ever. But no, but I suppose the reason why I brought up the tariffs was I wonder how this is going to affect cloud businesses that like Google, for instance, who runs a fairly decent sized cloud. How does this affect them bringing equipment in from China and from various other countries around the world?
So I was having a think about that myself this morning, right? Because putting aside the pure cost perspective, right? We know that hardware has been limited to get. Yeah. And also, you know, certain cloud regions like the Google, like Australian regions, have been capacity constrained.
Yep.
All right. If we're in a situation where a server that's manufactured in China is going to attract, you know, 134% tariff if it gets shipped to the US, and it's going to attract no tariff when it goes to Australia, right? Where would Google want to spend their capacity budget?
Yeah, that's right. That's like, actually probably a good thing for us.
for us, it might be a good thing.
Yeah. But yeah, because you got to think about that. And like my rough pricing on what these Dell nodes cost for GCVE is that they're costing Google somewhere in the vicinity. Their list price is about $75,000 each for the VE1 nodes. So I haven't looked at the VE2s yet. But the VE1s, when I was looking it up in my Dell partner portal, it said that they were about $75,000 to buy. So Google's not spending anywhere near that. Like they're buying thousands of these things. If you're adding 134% tariff to that, let's say that Google buys them for $50,000 a piece. You're now looking at $120,000 for the same server if you buy it into the US. Whereas if you buy it into Australia, then it's probably going to cost you $60,000 because of the Australia tax. And then we ship it over to the US and it cops a 10% tariff. So you're up for 66.
Well, yeah. So that's there is a term. I think it's like tariff washing, which is about, shipping things to third countries. Now, where you would run afoul of that. So Dell couldn't do this, right? Like they would get breached for that. Smaller companies, though, may look at doing that. They may go, okay, yeah, we'll ship from here to you, and then you rebadge it as a product of Malaysia, for example. Like, they have assembly there, so it's like, yep, we ship it there. Now it's a product of Malaysia, and it attracts whatever Malaysia's rate is. So, that we might see things like that. It's very much like black market sort of approach. See like black market of like NVIDIA GPUs that aren't supposed to go to China but do.
Yep. I do see those. And you can buy them online and they are hideously cheap, but also they generally don't work real well.
it's a very strange time. It's throwing a lot of spanners into the global economy. Never mind my superannuation balance. Look at even like in the consumer space, right? Like, Nintendo's got like they've announced the new Switch, right? The Switch 2, and they've announced a price, and they're not doing pre-orders into the US, and I think they've stopped for Canada as well. Because they don't want the Yanks taking all the Canadian pre-orders.
Oh, right.
Because they don't know what the end price is going to be.
Yeah, that's
right. So they have a release date, but you can't pre-order it because we can't guarantee. Like it might be $700, it might be $1,500.
I'm going to have to look it up because I do like the Nintendo.
Yeah, so like I'm able to pre-order one here. We've been able to do that because, not in the US. So Nintendo's holding off on that one. So, there's a surprising one that because that's going to be very popular. I know Framework, we were talking last podcast about, Linux laptops and stuff. And the Framework laptops, they've stopped shipping one of them to the US because they're like, nah, we'll lose money. Like, we can't ship it at this price. So,
yeah, that's crazy.
And this is just a small aspect of what's a wider economic kind of
impact. I feel like it's going to be like I understand what's trying to happen over there with the resetting manufacturing in the country, but I think it's going to take a lot longer than what they think it is.
Well, no, it takes.
It's going to take years and years. Like, you can't stand up manufacturing facilities for all of that infrastructure that you've just tariffed 100% of overnight. It's going to take years to get that up and running.
Also, the equipment you need to build the factories has now been tariffed.
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah, so you can't buy steel in from China because that's tariffed, and you can't buy all the componentry for all your electronics because like that's only made in TSMC in China and. That's been tariffed. So it's going to be an interesting one to watch happen. And on the Switch, I'm just looking at it. You can pre-order it from EB Games for $700.
Yeah, they're a little pricey. Yeah.
Ouch. I'll wait.
maybe wait for Christmas.
Yeah. Exactly. You can pick one up secondhand.
But,
So on that, Google Next, we were talking about Google Next earlier on.
We were indeed.
This morning about how much has dropped. And we've got a wee list because we do like lists.
We do like a list. This isn't even like into like the show. We're still in the banter part of the show, but we're already listing, baby.
Yeah, yeah. That's
the kind of crazy things that happen when it's just Dave and Ian.
Yeah. Hey, you leave us unattended.
Yeah, take that, Banky. Yeah. All right, list me.
Yeah, yeah, righto. So Google WAN. You wrote this one in, so give us the... Give us a quick and dirty on it.
Yeah, so Google WAN, at least from the very preliminary stuff I've been able to read this morning, is basically allowing you to use Google's internal backhaul as your WAN solution. So instead of, I mean, do you ever go back in the day of, you know, MPLS networks? I mean, yep. The amount of money that we used to spend with Orange to access their MPLS, oof.
Yep, MPLS networks and then IPVPNs because, you know, that was the cool thing to do.
Yeah, and then we moved to SD-WAN. I was like, yep. Hey, it's great. You know, you don't have to pay this, but, you know, you were traversing the internet for all your SD-WAN. So now this gives you a lovely new solution where instead of, like, public internet SD-WAN, you can punch into Google's network, especially if you've got like a point-to-point connection.
And I'm assuming that's using your VPC, your VPC subnets or networks throughout the world to traverse that traffic. So it's all on your tenant.
Yeah, it should indeed be.
Yeah.
Right. So this is a point of, I guess, you know, you would have your interconnects or your partner interconnects straight in from your colo facilities or your on-prem, and then you once you're in the network, you just pop out wherever you need to go. So you access your apps that are in Google Cloud, but if I need to go from my office in LA to one in Melbourne, I can go over Google's network to do it.
Yeah, nice.
Cool. So, yeah, real nice. So, yeah, it's supposed to be faster and, like, I think it was, like, 40% faster and about 40% cheaper than, I think, managing a separate WAN solution.
Oh, it would be too. Because you've just got to think of the egress costs and the cross-region traffic costs, basically. It's going to be miles cheaper.
Yeah. So that's really nice. Also, we've got some hardware announcements.
We do, yeah. So 7th gen TPU, which is nicknamed Ironwood, it's been unveiled. It's a specifically designed chip to enhance the performance of AI models, particularly in inference tasks. And obviously, it's a fairly significant investment and advancement for Google. So some key features for it. It's optimized for inference, like I said, unlike its predecessors. It's tailored specifically for inference, not just loose processing that we use in AI models. Its performance is 10 times the performance of the previous generation of TPU, which is a huge step. You remember the 80s and 90s when, you know, every Intel CPU was 100% faster than the last Intel CPU.
Yeah, I mean, there was Moore's Law, you know, RIP Moore's Law, but...
Yeah, exactly. This is 1,000 times. This is 1,000%. Yeah, baby. Sorry.
You got Moore's Cubed Law.
Yeah, that's it. The architecture allows for configurations ranging from 256 chip clusters to deployments of up to 9,216 chips, which offers 42.5 exaflops of compute power per pod.
Yeah, and I saw a comparison in the podcast that was saying like one of the leading supercomputers is like 1.5 exaflops. And this is 24 times more in density in just in one pod.
Yeah. Yeah, it's massive. And Ironwood is twice as efficient in energy as its predecessor. So That's obviously a huge bonus. AI consumes some astronomical amount of power in order to run models and train models and all that. It is by far the biggest consumer of power in clouds now.
I wonder if that means, okay, if it's 10 times more performant and 5 times more efficient, twice as more efficient. Does it mean it uses 5 times the power?
Probably, yeah.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah. So it doesn't mean that it's It doesn't mean that it's more energy efficient than the previous model. It's just more energy efficient based on the compute
per unit of compute. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. It's like the Intel chips. You know, they like, oh, we've got this new fancy chip, but it uses a little bit more power. It's the same chip as the last time. They've just pumped the power up.
Yeah, baby. All gas, no brakes.
Yeah, that's it. Brake, late, and turn racing.
And how many regions have we got now?
Well, we've got 42 now.
42. That's enough. We've got enough regions.
Yeah, well, so we've got the new regions that we covered, I think, in the last podcast, or maybe it was a podcast before, is Sweden, South Africa, and Mexico. And then we've got rapid expansion underway in Kuwait, Malaysia, and Thailand. So Google Cloud is just on this massive growth path at the moment.
And I think that more international fiber as well. Like, we're just...
Yeah, it's phenomenal. The network that Google runs just for cloud alone is just, it's mind-boggling how big it is. Google actually has a really cool map that you can look at, and I can't remember where it is, but you can search for it on the internet, and it'll show you all the different fiber connections that go from data center to data center and from... like the subsea cable and all that sort of stuff. It's, yeah, just phenomenal.
Yeah. Now, if only we could just get a West Coast one in Australia, that'd be real nice. Give us a Perth DC, Google. But, come on.
But only JK lives over there. We don't worry about Perth.
we got no one in Perth, right?
Yeah, there's no one in Perth. Shout out to JK. He's actually at Next at the moment, trickling updates to me every now and then. So next one that I've got on the list here is VLLM to TPUs, GKE inferencing, and pathways availability. Now, I had to Google what VLLM is.
I've got no idea, mate. This is all you.
Yeah. So VLLM is an inferencing library that is used in GKE inferencing to do a whole heap of decision making. So it does serving throughput and management and all sorts of really cool stuff. But the GKE inferencing bit of it is all about how to scale your cluster and all that sort of stuff using AI to look at all of the peaks and troughs and automatically scale the cluster and the pods based on its intelligence.
Oh, amazing.
And then pathways, and I've got to go back to the slide deck that Google sent out this morning. About this, because as
hot
we said earlier,
presses,
we
are guys.
Under embargo until this morning. It shows, there it is, pathways on Google. So it shows flexible computing with disaggregated serving, integrated control with training code, easier debugging at scale, error aggregation, interactivity at any scale, aka interactive supercomputing. So it does some really cool stuff inside of your clusters to automatically scale things the way it thinks it should.
I think it's interesting seeing how this is working versus how, like, GKE or Kubernetes in general kind of used to work. You know, you had all your auto-scaling, but it was very much like, okay, when I hit these thresholds, then I will do things.
Yeah.
So actually looking at it predictively of like, oh, hey, actually we're about to hit like 3 p.m. in this particular region. We usually see an uptick now. I'll just do that for you.
Well, and that's the thing. So the AI is then capable of analyzing your trends over a period of time and saying, I know that at 9 o'clock in the morning, you're going to start ramping traffic up. So I'm going to, at 8:50, put another node into the cluster, another two nodes, or whatever it requires in order to be able to meet that demand proactively.
Right. Without having your DevOps team having to kind of laboriously sort of model out a few things and.
Yeah. Or on the flip side of that, if you're just using just general GKE auto scaling, so cluster auto scaling and then HPAs, the process there is, hey, we've got more than 50% CPU on this pod. We need to scale it. So that scales. Hang on, we don't have enough nodes in the node pool. We need to scale that. So we've got to wait 5 minutes for that to come up, and then we can scale the pods. So by then, you've already missed your RPO, your targets, your objectives. Yep. So this is a proactive way of doing that. And then on the flip side of that, it's a proactive way of scaling it down. So the AI knows that, hey, at 11 o'clock at night, your traffic just drops off a cliff. So instead of waiting the 10, 15, maybe half an hour that auto-scaling takes to just shrink the cluster down node by node, it just goes, well, you know, we're not going to need this many. Let's evacuate these three nodes out of your cluster and kill them.
Yeah, bro.
And then the last one on the list, AI on-prem, Dave, talk to me.
Yeah. So this was in the keynote. So they had, a nice little blurb there from Jensen from NVIDIA. So really talking about like what did he refer to? He called it the super partnership between NVIDIA and Google. Right, because the NVIDIA is working with Google at every level of the stack in their AI systems and the infrastructure. I'm sure there's plenty of blue field networking chips going on in there. Like it's just they're all
in on NVIDIA.
Yeah. So, but the big announcement there is that like everyone, especially all large enterprises, wants AI, but not everyone can be in the public cloud. So what they're announcing there is that Google Distributed Cloud, which is, where you can have a stack of literally an on-prem stack of, sort of Google supplied hardware. So you can run your cloud services, but in your own DC, is going to be available with the NVIDIA chips as well, right? So you'll be able to have these AIs running on-prem in your own DC.
Nice.
Right, even if you're a highly regulated industry.
Yeah, that's fantastic. That's, like we said, there's so many things coming out, and this is just the tip of the iceberg. This is literally like the keynote and a few little bits and pieces that I know about prior to this, because being a GDE, we get access to this sort of stuff, but we weren't allowed to talk about it or disclose it until this morning.
So it's all aligned.
Yeah.
That's
so stay tuned. The next 3 days are going to be absolutely insane with the number of announcements. I did see a number there that Google has made something like 3,000 improvements across the board in the last 12 months, and substantial improvement. We're not talking about they changed the color of a button. We're talking about substantial improvements to the products.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I've seen heaps in Workspace alone. I used some of the Gemini features in Workspace this morning when I was sort of putting together that intro script. I was like, hey, I need to put together this script. And I was like, oh, just help me with a little temp template. I don't need you to put the text in. Just flesh out the template for me and I'll go write it in afterwards. And off it goes.
Nice.
Just being able to do that all natively, like in the tool itself. I'm not having to go off to Gemini and then get something and then bring it across.
Yeah, and that's super cool. Now, on an entirely different note, something that's more local to Australia, I just saw this article pop into my inbox, was NBN Co. and 33 smaller broadband infrastructure operators may be required to offer services capable of 100 meg, which is up from the baseline 25 meg, under a proposal floated by the Federal Communications Department. So it looks like we might actually get 100 meg as the minimum or the baseline service in NBN from now on.
That's good.
It's so good.
I think I saw that article pop up, but I hadn't read it yet because I was too busy with all this next stuff.
And that doesn't mean that sub 100 meg services are going to go away. It just means that the minimum service that is going to be offered from here on in, if this is all approved, of course, is going to be 100 meg.
Right. So instead of because I think the cheapest NBN plan's 25 meg.
25.2, I think it is.
Lot of that is supposed to bump up later in the year. I think I want to say it's October is, I think, when the new tiers are supposed to go live.
Yeah. So this is all very much pie in the sky at the moment, but it looks like it might actually go through. Which will also mean another round of investment to NBN Co. to upgrade a whole heap of those services that are only capable of 25 megasecond.
Still on a tail end fiber to the node connection.
Yeah, or people who are still on one of the old connections that are 5 kilometers away from a node, which is about the distance that you'll get out of VDSL, they'll need to get a node closer to them, or they'll need to get a fiber upgrade. So yeah, that's just one that's hot off the press.
Very good. We'd love to see that, right? Like the NBN has been such a game changer in Australia, especially like because it was, I'm going to throw big quotes around the word complete, but the initial kind of rollout done, like just as like COVID kicked off and we were all stuck working from home, like there's no way I would have been able to work as effectively back then, back on my old ADSL connection.
Well, and that's the thing. So we had, because I live rurally, as you know, and up here there was, when we first moved up here 10 years ago, there was very few people on the D-SLAM that sits just up the road from me. We were 150 odd meters from the D-SLAM. Now, it was a non-integrated RIM. For those who don't know, a non-integrated RIM, the RIM is what Telstra used to call the, it was like a local exchange, essentially. It was one of those big cabinets that sat on the side of the road. It had a top hat on it, so another cabinet that sat on top of it. That was the ADSL bit. And it was non-integrated. So Telstra couldn't control it per se from their software in their data centers. They had to send techs out. They could do basic things like power cycle it and that sort of stuff, but that was it. And on ADSL here, we were getting 24 megasecond. We were at the fastest you could get because we're 150 meters by cable.
Yeah.
Then NBN came through and all of a sudden we could get 50 megasecond from Telstra, or I could go to a different provider and get 100 megasecond. And so we went to a different provider because more megabits per second is better.
It is always better.
Always better. And because everything is streaming services now. So you can't stream, we've got 4K TVs, you can't stream 4K on 100 megasecond. It just doesn't work. So we changed to that, and then fiber came through end of last year and we upgraded straight to fiber and we're on gigabit now, and I couldn't go back to 100 megasecond, let alone 25 megasecond. Like if my phone's not responding with 100 megasecond, I get cranky.
I'm a big fan of like Xbox Game Pass, as a subscription, right? And I was firing up a game for my son that was like he wanted to play something new. We've had a look through Game Pass. There's a game that he wants to play, and it was like 80 gig to download, right? And I think it took an hour.
Yep.
Right? He's like, oh, it's so slow. I'm like, this is 80 gig.
This was like when we were on ADSL 2 and we were like super fast, not the original ADSL, which was a 1500 256 connection. And I remember it because I got one as soon as they came out. But when we had ADSL 2 and you're on the max speed you could on ADSL 2, my son used to turn the Xbox on in the sunroom out the back here where his gaming systems are all set up, and he'd be like, oh, I need to do this update to whatever farming sim or whatever it was. It was like 60 gig. He'd leave his Xbox turned on all night and he'd come back the next afternoon and it'd be downloaded. Like it would have only just finished like an hour or so beforehand.
Yeah, I know. It's just amazing how you just get spoiled by this sort of stuff. Like, oh, man, I can remember having to download like patches for World of Warcraft, like back when, like 20 years ago when I was sort of first playing that, and like, man, patch day came out and it's like, well, I'm not doing anything else today.
Yep, that's it. Cool. So I suppose we should get on with some community
get out
stuff,
of the banter.
Yeah, we should get on with some community stuff, eh?
All right, let's kick it across to the community news.
Awesome. All right. So three events that I found that are going on in the community this fortnight. So GDG Melbourne has their April coding night on the 16th. So that's in 6 days' time. That will be at the Mantle Group office. I think it is. Yeah, it's 452 Flinders Street. I think that's the Mantle Group office. But their details are on the links. There's a meetup link there. Starts at 5:45, goes through till 8. University of New South Wales, Sydney campus has their GDG on campus event. It's a build with AI workshop using Gemini and Vertex AI for resume and job matching. That's happening on the 22nd. Again, that will be at Google Sydney, which is generally where these guys have their things. That'll be 5:30 in the afternoon on the 22nd. Again, there's links in the show notes. And Google Cloud Sydney has the same event listed. So it must be a joint venture between UC and Google GDG Cloud Sydney. So yeah, they're doing the same event. It's at Google, 22nd at 5:30 PM.
Very nice. Get on it.
Yeah.
All right. And taking us across to the. I've used it as part of the people news segment because it is about people and some people that you and I know very well.
Yep.
I wanted to give a shout out to Mantle Group, sponsors of the podcast.
Yep.
They have a well-deserved congratulations because they have just taken out the Australia and New Zealand Partner of the Year for Google Cloud
for the third year running. Yeah, nice. Congratulations to Simon and the entire Mantle Group team. That is amazing news. We have fond memories of Mantle Group.
Yeah, and you know, Nee Kasner back in the day. So yeah, those guys are super dedicated and they're just absolutely well deserved.
Such a cool name for a business.
Yeah.
So it's the same as Google. I won't give the secret away, but there is a secret as to the reason why it was named Kasner. And it has a lot to do with the reason why Google is named Google.
But, hey, Mantle Group's still a fine name, and it's all the same wonderful people there.
Yeah, definitely. Just doesn't have the ring that Kasner does.
No. All righty. So now let's jump across. We've got our first industry topic. And now I covered this in the intro. Broadcom.
Oh, they've done it again. They really have.
Oh my god.
So you know, we covered this a while ago where Broadcom has taken over VMware and their renewals are up like 1,000%. Minimum 100%, but the vast majority of businesses saw far more than 100% increase in their pricing.
Yeah. Cranked it up.
Broadcom have now decided that they're increasing the cost of VMware for some customers by boosting the minimum purchase of cores from 16 to 72.
Yeah, this is effective today, April the 10th.
Yep.
Right. So if you are buying a VMware solution today and you've got a 2 CPU host that you're wanting to run 16 gig CPUs in it, right, for 32 cores totally, you're having to license 72.
Yep. So, yeah, the example here is if a customer has a single processor with 8 cores, VMware by Broadcom will license 72. On the other hand, if a customer has 5 dual processor servers with 16 cores each or 160 cores, VMware by Broadcom will license 160 cores. And the other part of this is this new requirement may require adjustments to your current quotes. So even though you have current quote, you have a current quote, your quote is current, like it's still in its validity period. Yeah. Yep. You're not covered by that quote anymore.
They're just void at all current quotes.
Yeah. And that's shady business. I'm sorry, but that's just shady business. The other thing that got my goat up about this story is Broadcom is also implementing a penalty equivalent to 20% of the price of the first year subscription, so the maximum amount of money you'll pay, for customers that have not renewed their subscription licenses by their anniversary date. So if you
if you don't have it on auto renew,
yep, and you miss it, then you're going to pay an extra 20% on top of the first year subscription price. So, like your renewal prices, back when I ran a VMware cluster like that, you know, our renewal price would be like $5,000 a year. The new price to buy it was like $15,000. So 20% on top of that $15,000 if you fail to renew your $5,000, which will no longer be $5,000. It'll be more like $10,000 or $12,000. So yeah, this is price gouging, the epitome of price gouging. It really is. And I can see a lot of smaller businesses that just refuse flatly to license 72 cores for their single node that they've got, looking elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, it's not viable. It's like I'm aghast. Right. Yep. And you want a little third whammy on this one?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
A third?
Yeah. Here's a third little bugbear. So your patches for VMware.
Yeah.
Very important that you keep your cluster up to date.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Behind the paywall now.
Really?
Yep. Right. If you are out of your subscription,
mm-hmm.
Right. Patches will no longer work. You're going to have to have a login token for your host patch, right? And for your vCenter to patch. And if your subscription is not valid, no patches for you.
Yeah, see, that's garbage. Sorry, that is. So, because I remember a lawsuit a while ago where Microsoft did something similar, and a PC was then infected that caused a huge amount of financial loss for I can't remember whether it was a company or an individual. And Microsoft got sued for it and they lost. So my question then becomes, is Broadcom now going to be subject to the same style lawsuits where they're refusing to allow patches to now unlicensed clusters?
Yeah, I mean, the amount of like, you know, 10, like number 10 CVEs that yep. will hit like vCenter. In any given year.
Yeah, it's huge. Yeah, right. Well,
so look, like that's a real platform risk.
There is. And look, I can highly recommend Proxmox. It's a fantastic little system for smaller stuff. If you're running bigger clusters, Zen Server, I have used that in anger in the past and it is pretty damn good. I think Proxmox is probably ahead of it these days, but I haven't used it in a few years. So, you know.
Sure. And if you're having to work on VMware, you know, really look at something like GCVE and like get onto VMware Engine, get it off prem. Like that's let Google manage that side for you.
It's probably not going to be as relevant to smaller businesses that only have like one or two hosts because GCVE is a fairly beefy sort of system.
Yeah, it's not going to cover your small.
No, but those smaller businesses, I mean, you're already getting absolutely smashed by Broadcom licensing now. So if you're not already looking at something else, you should be.
Oh, you know, I just realized, you know, that because there's another use case that, you know, like you do like not just CPU pinning, but like BIOS disabling cores on hosts.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if you're running Oracle workloads,
yep.
right? Or if you've got another software package that is running on your cluster that is also getting core licensing. So now you could have a situation where you go, actually, I only wanted 8 cores for my database. So I've disabled cores on this box. But I've now had to license 72 cores for it.
Yep.
Like that.
Ugh. Yeah. Yeah. It really is a massive kick in the backside.
Yes.
It really
get off VMware, people. Yeah. Also get off Oracle.
Yeah. Well, that's right. Don't use Oracle. We'll cover why later.
Yeah. Yeah, they didn't sponsor the podcast. Right
now. No, that's right.
They didn't let's go broad. So.
But speaking of backdoors and CVEs and the likes, Apple is appealing against the UK's backdoor order.
Oh, yeah. So this was some of their, I know they've removed some services that were enabled for the UK because they couldn't comply with this requirement. Yeah.
Yeah. So Apple removed their advanced data protection, which is their encryption for their cloud data, a little while ago. But the UK government is ordering them to create a backdoor to its encrypted cloud storage systems. And Apple's fighting back, as they should do too, because, you know, backdoors are never, ever a good idea to anyone. The only people who think they're a good idea are politicians and, like, sorry, but they don't know anything.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong, like the spooks, right? Like the MI6 grad, of course they want it.
Yeah,
they want a backdoor. They'd love to be able to walk through. It's like, but everyone needs to fight back against.
Yeah, 100% they do. So, yeah, Apple is saying that this is a bad idea and they are challenging it in court to ensure that it doesn't go on because, you know, it is bad for customers' data. It's bad for your privacy. It's bad for, and insert anything there.
Yeah. So this was IT News has covered this where they've pulled through some reporting from the Washington Post about it. So, Britain had issued this technical capability notice to Apple that they should enable access to encrypted messages and photos, even for users outside the country.
Yep.
All right. So not even just UK data. So, yeah. How about no?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The computer says no.
Yeah. I mean, the problem is for a lot of these issues, not necessarily just specifically this UK one, but I think it was the Australian anti-encryption laws a few years back. And it was like if you got tapped from ASIO or like they said, like you need to implement this thing, you were never allowed to talk about it. Like,
yeah.
So like, what do you do?
Yeah, that's right. It's crazy. To be honest, you're already being tapped and all that sort of stuff. So the worst that's going to happen is you're going to go to jail.
Yeah.
So pipe up.
yeah.
All right. Let's get on with some Google news, shall we? Some more Google news.
Yeah.
All right. So the first one we've got up is BigQuery repositories. So Google has released BigQuery repositories, which provide a comprehensive set of features to integrate Git workflows directly in your BigQuery environment. So
this would be for helping like data analysis teams.
Yeah. So this is to assist with data teams that want to use Git to collaborate effectively and adopt software management best practices. So software engineering best practices where everything is in Git, you're using pipelines to do everything. You're not manually copying and pasting the old copy pasta trick. Because we all know that, you know, copy pasta is good, but it's still prone to the PEBCAC issue. So
And I suppose a lot of data engineers would have been doing this anyway, but they would be doing it kind of offline, right? They might have their workbooks and things in Git, but it's not directly, wasn't directly integrated with BigQuery.
That's right. And now what this allows you to do is set up repositories in BigQuery Studio where you can develop your SQL queries, your notebooks, do all your data prep, data canvases, all that sort of stuff. It allows you to connect your repositories to remote Git hosts, so you can use GitHub and GitLab and in Bitbucket and whatever other public Git platform you use. You can edit your code in the repositories within a dedicated workspace on your own copy of the code before publishing changes to the branch, and it allows you to perform most Git operations with a user-friendly interface that lets you inspect differences, commit changes, you know, all your normal Git workflow stuff. And that all happens within BigQuery Studio. So you don't have to leave BigQuery Studio. You're in the studio. You've got a single pane of glass to work from and you can get your BigQuery stuff done in there in Git.
Oh, yeah. I'm just having a look at the little GIF that they've got on there. It's showing, like, you can actually do your commits, you can do your pull request, all in there. You don't have to step off to any other tool.
Yeah, that's right. So really, really cool advancement. And this is one of the ones that's getting released. Well, it has been released. It was released on March 21st. And I do believe that it had some bonus features that were announced at Next. But there's some AI stuff that got integrated into this that's announced in Next. So, you know.
Brilliant.
Yep.
All right. What else have we got? What else is new?
So Artifact Registry has got virtual repos.
Okay. And we would use this for what?
Okay. So a virtual repo is a single access point to get to your artifacts. So a virtual repo sits in front of multiple remote repos. So you can think of this as like an entry point or an ingress
collection,
an ingress controller. In GKE terms, you've got an ingress controller that controls access to all the different pods. This is like the ingress controller for Artifact Registry repositories. So it gives you that single point of entry that allows you to access all of the different repositories that you've got behind it.
Right. Okay.
So you can have, as a good example, I know we have Yum repos and we've got Python repos and we've got a whole heap of different types of repositories in our environment. Currently, they're all accessed via their individual URLs in Artifact Registry. This would put a single access point in front of that. So you'd have like australiasoutheast1.dev.package.dev/repo name.
Gotcha. Okay. So you could actually just do something very simple, like example, like your Yum update, right? It is just having a single one that's like your company name's, you know, repo production.
Yep.
Right. Like, and you can set which level you got the developer ones instead of just having to have each individual application that you use downstream.
Yeah, that's right. And then you can prioritize your upstream repositories. So you've got all these upstream repos that have all your different packages. You could have two of the same repo there, but one with a higher priority. So you can say, this is the enterprise Linux packages, and these are the Fedora packages, for instance. We're going to go with the EL packages before we get a Fedora package. So if you can't find it in EL, then you use Fedora.
Gotcha. Oh, that is very cool.
Yeah. So currently it supports Docker, Go, Maven, NPM, and Python. And in private preview, we've got apt and yum packages, package types or repositories, I should say, that are available. So go and check that one out. That's really cool.
Now, let's come across to a little bit of security news here. We touched on this before. Now, I wanted to talk about this last fortnight, about this, what was seeming to be a breach of Oracle Cloud.
And I think we did touch on it a little bit last fortnight that, you know, Oracle Cloud looks like it might have been breached.
Yeah, there was some leaks, and yet Oracle was denying that there had been any breach. This is now looking like it's very much a legitimate attack.
Yeah.
The threat actor. We will link to the article, which is from Cybersecurity Dive. The threat actor Rose87168 had provided lists of like company data and had shown like they were able to put a file onto one of Oracle's servers. Now, this is not a customer's server in Oracle. This was on Oracle infrastructure.
Yeah, on the actual hosts behind it.
Yeah. They said they had 6 million data records and affecting more than 140,000 tenants. Now, initially, Oracle denied it. Said, yep. Nah, didn't happen. This is fake, and nothing, you know, nothing to worry about. It now appears that this is a very real thing.
Oh yeah. Yeah, so it's actually been listed as a CVE. So the alleged breach was linked to a CVE listed as CVE 2021-35587. A vulnerability. So
it's quite an old one, right? Yeah, it's a couple of years old.
Yeah. It's 2021. A vulnerability in Oracle Access Manager product of Oracle Fusion Middleware. So it's actually part of the authentication system that Oracle is using is flawed and hasn't been patched in Oracle Cloud by the looks of things.
Yeah, so he was able to unauthenticated access over HTTP, yep. Get access to the server,
yep,
and do what he wanted.
Yeah, so so as you said, Oracle denied it. And we did touch on it. I can't remember if it was last podcast or the one before. Oracle denied it point blank and saying it's all fake. The threat actor has come out and produced a portion of data, and they've shown that, you know, this isn't fake. This is 100% legitimate. And
security researchers have come out and confirmed it as well.
Yeah, and that's what I was just about to say. Cloud SEK, and there was another one mentioned in this article as well. Trustwave Spider Labs. Yeah, they've come out and said, no, this is 100% legitimate. Trustwave Spider Labs have released a blog post last week confirming the hacker is threatening to sell stolen data and offering multiple purchase options based on the company name, hash credentials, and other criteria. So it is legit. I would.
It's been very perplexing seeing the way Oracle has handled this one.
Well, I think it's the same as most big US companies do. Like, oh, we've been breached, deny it. Straight away deny it. There's nothing to see here. We haven't done anything wrong. And then only when there's overwhelming evidence that we go, oh, yeah, okay. We got breached.
Well, surely this is going to put them in additional breach. I think there's like Australian information security laws. There'll be EU one. Let's assume that probably no one's going to come after them in the US because the DOJ will just not do anything. But for worldwide,
definitely.
Probably not going to look good for Oracle.
Certainly in Australia, there is a law that says that they must disclose this sort of breach immediately to the Office of the Australian Information Commissioner. I'm assuming that the EU has even more strict laws.
I would expect so.
Because they've got more strict laws on pretty much everything to do with information. So, you know, they could be facing fines in Australia. Whether that eventuates or not is yet to be seen. But it just calls out that there is actually a vulnerability in the single sign-on credentials. So the information here says the stolen data includes single sign-on credentials, LDAP passwords, OAuth2 keys, and tenant data. Right, and it does look like that there is a vulnerability in Oracle Access Manager in Oracle Fusion Middleware. So if you're using it, please make sure it's patched and your systems are safe.
Okay.
More hacking. Yep. Speaking of things that have been hacked, Australian Super.
Yeah, it's a real, well, and not them directly, right? This is more of a user accounts sort of attack.
What's happened here is an attacker has managed to get hold of some credentials.
Yeah, I think from what I'm reading here is that they have credentials for about 600 users,
yep.
And four users have had about $500,000 stolen.
Yes,
from their super funds.
So the National Cybersecurity Coordinator, Lieutenant General Michelle McGuinness, said cyber criminals have targeted individual accounts at several superannuation funds. At this point, all of these superannuation funds look like they are host. What's the super fund, the industry super fund?
Oh, yeah.
As well as Insignia Financial. So Insignia Financial is the outlier here. So we've got Australian Retirement Trust, Australian Super, Host Plus, and Rest. From my recollection, they're all industry super funds except for Insignia. Now, none of that has been confirmed yet. At this point, we don't know if the other funds are actually caught up in this, or whether they're it's just a a correlation error?
Yeah, I think from what I'm seeing across the different funds, like MLC has said, yeah, they've seen about 100 customer accounts not actually breached, but like unusual
activity.
Like access on activity yep. on them. REST said 8,000 members have been like.
Yeah,
but they haven't lost anything yet, but you know, definitely seeing, I suppose, like a lot of login attempts against their accounts.
Yeah, and look, I'm with Australian Super, so I was like, "Ooh, what's going on here?" And obviously, I've got a fair amount of money in Super, so you know, I'm.
But I mean, we all do as a nation.
Yeah,
it's like the second highest amount of retirement savings in the world. Like we've been putting 10% of our salaries aside. 25 years or something.
Since we were employed. But I will give a huge commendation to the industry super funds that have responded to this and like everybody who's responded to this. REST Chief Executive Vicky Doyle has said that we responded by immediately shutting down the member access portal, undertaking investigations and launching a cybersecurity incident response protocols, which I think for what we've seen lost, like we've seen four individuals, I think it was, that lost $500,000 each.
I think it was $500,000 total. I don't think it was each. Like it's really actually, we're actually only talking, I was like only,
yeah,
because obviously it matters to those people, but we're only talking about $500,000 for the scale of response that is coming across the industry.
Hmm.
I think you're right. I think this is sort of quite commendable.
Yeah. This is an example of how you should respond to a cybersecurity incident. Oracle, take note.
But and I think it was right. Like, yeah, go shut access down. Like, hey, we're seeing something real bad. Let's stop for a sec.
Put a really big banner on your main page of your website that says, hey, we've detected unusual login. We are shutting down the member portal for X number of hours so that we can investigate and it'll be back up and running so that people aren't spooked, which is what happened. People were spooked because they couldn't get access. The portal was under so much load that that it just couldn't respond to people.
Yeah. And you know, like you stuck any of these rumors out there of like, oh, the Superfund itself, like as in like the back end has been breached and they're draining the super accounts. Like, no, it was really more like front end user account. Someone just logged in with your credentials.
Yeah. And that's the first thing I heard. So my wife works in insurance and she got an email through to say, hey, Australian Super's been breached. And I was like, what? What do you mean it's been breached? And she was like, oh, Australian Super's been breached. That's all I know. And I'm like, oh, I'm frantically Googling it going, what's going on? And it sounded very much like the first reports were that Australian Super itself had been breached. It was user accounts that had been breached that might be using the same password amongst multiple different things, you know, doing all the things that you shouldn't do with passwords.
Yeah. But everyone, when I say everyone, when I say like the vast majority of people do, especially older people who either may be retired now or, you know, very soon approaching, like my father-in-law isn't going to switch to pass keys.
No.
Right? Like that's not going to happen.
My mum used to have a little black book sitting beside the computer with the passwords written in it. And because I made her change her password so that everything was different. And she was like, this is horrible to try and manage. How do I manage this? And I tried to get her onto a password manager. And she was like, no, I don't trust that because that's stored in the cloud and I don't trust the cloud. And I'm like, okay, fair enough. Look, that's best, worst case scenario, write them in a book beside your computer. I mean, it requires physical access to the machine in order to get it. There's no one that comes into our house that would know to look in that little book because it was sort of sitting in a little drawer to find the passwords. And if you don't have a password manager, look, and you don't want to use a password manager, I will say that whilst it's not a good idea, it's better than using the same password across the board.
Yeah, except, you know, coming back with the whole, like, having the passwords next to the computer in any way, shape, or form, because if someone's digging through, you go, oh, here's the computer, let me go check all the drawers, and under the desk, ah, there it is.
Yeah, This was literally a little, like, it was one of those little tiny Spirax notebooks that you get, little notepad that Dad used to use on the building site, used to sit in his top pocket. It had been
carpenter's pencil.
It was written in with a carpenter's pencil most of the time. But it literally just had, in her little book, it'd have like Gmail, and then it'd have a word written underneath it. And it was Mum's prompt. It wasn't the actual password. It was her prompt to go, that's the password for this.
Oh, yeah. It's the hash for the password.
That's right. Yeah. look, it was better than nothing. At that point, Mum used to have, and I mean, she's long gone now, sadly, but she used to have the same password for everything. Internet banking was the same as her super, which was the same as her Gmail, which was the same as her Facebook. And I'm like, no.
Yeah.
This is evil.
Yeah. And, you know, back in the day when, you know, you have like forums and things and use the same password for your bank on like some crap like guild forum.
Yep. Yeah. The old bulletin board that you had to sign in that you signed in over HTTP. Not even the secure version.
Some ancient version of PHP BB.
Yep. Yeah, that's right. So, look, we've got to commend Australian Super and all of those industry super funds and Insignia that got attacked there, because that was a really good response by them to sort of get
the,
rid
the
of-
only thing that I would say, if we do a cheers and jeers, right? It's like cheers for your rapid response, but jeers for our super funds in general, because most of them are pretty bad with 2FA.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're terrible.
Right? So I think that's probably the big one where I'd like to see the super funds stepping up.
Mm-hmm.
And embracing. I mean, I said, like, you know, about pass keys before, like, please do. Switch to pass keys, give me an option to use like a physical token, federate with my ID.
Do something that is better than passwords, because passwords suck.
Yeah. Yeah. And really, and better than SMS 2FA. Right?
Oh,
because again, in a targeted attack, right, SMS 2FA is terrible.
Yeah. Oh, 100% it is.
It's too easy to intercept.
Yep.
And our super funds in general are, like, on the whole, people have significantly more money in their super funds than they ever have in their bank accounts.
Yeah, 100% right? They do. Like, there's a whole lot of coin in my super funds, plural.
Yeah.
And yes, I have multiple super funds. And for the Australians that are sitting there going, you need to consolidate them. I can't. One of them is a military superannuation fund. It cannot be consolidated into my Australian Super, and my Australian Super cannot be consolidated into my military super because I'm no longer a serving member.
You also get a little annoying thing. If anyone's got like insurances through their super fund as well, I get messages saying you need to consolidate your super funds, but I don't really have two super funds. Like, one's empty. It's like a little placeholder that's required for like the insurances.
Yep.
Like, they create them in the background, but there's no money in it. Well, that's enough of our, delightful rabbit hole of superannuation discussions. It's time to kick off the AI Wars. AI Wars. Maybe we can AI Wars Banky's voice in there as well.
We 100% need that. Right.
Yeah, we do indeed. Maybe we could use some of the new Google AI tools and just have a virtualized Banky.
Yeah, well, I'm going to talk about those.
Yeah. All right, what's new?
Gemini 2.5 Pro is new. It's landed. It is amazing. There's so much to talk about with AI. I'm going to talk about one of the freakiest things I've seen in my life. I was on a call with Google the other day, part of the GDE group that we get the advanced notification of all this cool stuff. But one of the demos that we saw was voice. So Gemini can now do this really, I'm going to say, freaky thing where it can take a sample of your voice and then play, you can write some text out and it will read it in your voice with your inflection, with the same way that you speak. So we saw this, the gentleman that was demoing it, and I'm sorry, he is a Googler and I can't remember his name. He was a lovely dude. He did such a good demo, but he had a fairly thick accent to him, and he recorded just a snippet of his voice saying something along the lines of, you know, this is a recording of my voice, and then got Gemini to actually read a bit of text that he'd written up in his voice. And it sounded, and I mean, yes, okay, I'm a little bit deaf, but it sounded to me exactly like him. Like it could have been him speaking it, but it wasn't, because I was looking at him and his mouth was shut.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow, this is crazy.
This is ventriloquism, it'll never be the same again,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, this is like the ultimate of deepfake. Not only can I now clone the human's face and put it on someone else's body in Gemini, but now I can make that sound like the human.
Yeah, right. And, you know, pretty much in real time, right? Like you're sitting right there.
I was sitting there watching it. It the demo only lasted for like 30 seconds to a minute. But oh, it was freaky. But that was the scariest part for me. The rest of it is phenomenal. So to give you some overviews of what I saw the other day was VO2, which is the image to video model, now has new editing features. Lyra, which is the high quality music generation model, now has text to music. So you can literally generate a song by giving it some text and Lyra will go and generate.
And that's a new one, isn't it? That's a new one. Like that's the first release of that.
Chirp 3 is the text to speech model. This is the one that freaked me out. This is the, like, can clone voice snippets to say anything. And that is really scary. Google have also released the Vertex AI Model Development Service, which allows you to build and train your own models. And then there's a multi-agent framework, ADK, to deploy agents across multiple services. So that's just sort of some of the announcements. But in Gemini 2.5, this thing is insane. It is so much better and so much faster than every other model out there. I think
I've been seeing a lot of praise from the what's now called the vibe coding community.
And like, I had to Google this because I had no idea what vibe coding is. I don't use AI day to day for coding stuff.
You got to get on it, man. You're gonna install Cursor. You're gonna use an AI router, and you're gonna punch in with your. What is it? What are they using? Okay, so the trick that a lot of these guys are using is they're using the 2.5 Pro experimental model.
Yep,
which is free currently, or it might be about to be paid. But it's like the Pro model is paid and can get quite expensive. But if the experimental one was free,
Well, and that all goes to help training the model too. But I had to look up what vibe coding was because I was like, what is vibe coding? And vibe coding is just an AI-driven programming technique where users describe their desired software features and the AI tool generates it.
Yeah, it's basically you're corralling your AI and trying to convince a I'm trying to think of the way I saw it written. It was that, like, using, like, Claude Sonnet. Yep. It was kind of like, all right, you are a product manager or product owner, and you're trying to describe what you want to a junior engineer.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas using 2.5 Pro experimental, it was more like you're actually describing it to a kind of disgruntled senior engineer.
Aren't all senior, like, engineers disgruntled?
Yeah, well, pretty much, right? Like, so it's like, it'll do it for you, but you'll have to do some convincing.
Yeah, that's right. But look, Gemini 2.5 Pro is phenomenal. So across the benchmarks, its reasoning is phenomenal. It's humanity's last exam. So this is its reasoning and knowledge testing. It scored 18.8%, which is like 4.8% higher than the next highest score, which was OpenAI's O3 mini model. ChatGPT's 4.5 scored 6.4 in reasoning. So this gives you an idea of how much more advanced Gemini 2.5 Pro is than ChatGPT 4.5.
And they're referring to 2.5 as like the first thinking model.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't just spit out the next word. It actually takes a step and reasons its way through the response before coming back to you.
Yeah. Yeah. Sarah Cooper is, Sarah O'Connor, sorry, is rolling over in her grave. because AI is about to take over the world. No. We just go through quickly the stats. In science, the GPQA Diamond testing benchmark that they did, Gemini 2.5 Pro scored 84%. It's slightly behind Claude's 3.7 Sonnet with 84.4% and a little bit behind Grok 3 Beta with 84.6%. But it's still well up there. It's still in that ballpark with the 2 leaders. In mathematics, the AMI 2025 benchmark scored 86.7. It's a little bit behind Grok 3 Beta. Grok 3 Beta is 93.3%. But it's well ahead of pretty much everything else. OpenAI's O3 Mini is 86.5%. So it's a little bit in front of that. When it comes to the AMI 2024 test, it scored 92%. Again, Grok 3 Beta tipped the post at 93.3. Live code benchmark V5, so this is all code generation benchmarking. It scored 70.4%. It's a little bit behind Grok, which is 79.4, and OpenAI's O3 Mini is 74.1. But it's well ahead of DeepSeek's R1, which is 64.3. It beats everybody in the code editing, so the Ada polyglot. We're well ahead there with 74%. The agentic coding benchmark, the SWE bench verified, it's 7% behind Claude. Claude is 70.3%. Gemini is 63.8. So there's a little bit of learning to do there. Factuality. Now, this one's an interesting one. So simple Q&A. This is testing how factual the model actually is.
So instead of hallucinating.
Yeah, so it's testing its hallucinations and all that sort of stuff. So it's how factual is the model? 52.9% for Gemini, and OpenAI's GPT 4.5 is 62.5. So it's a little bit behind that, but, you know, there's room to improve here. Visual reasoning. So this is the MMMU benchmark, 81.7, well ahead of everything else, like 3% in front of Grok, which is the next highest, well in front of Claude and OpenAI's ChatGPT 4.5. Image understanding. So this is where you can give Gemini an image and get it to describe what it sees in the image. It is truly freaky. You can give it a pixelated image and it'll do a fairly good interpretation of what's in that image. So I can see this being used to thwart the, the Are You Human checkers on websites.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, type in these letters. No, I won't. I will close your website. 69.4%. A lot of the others don't have results for this. O3 Mini doesn't have MM support, and DeepSeek also doesn't have MM support. Long context. So we all know that the Gemini has super long context windows. So the MRCR benchmark, 94.5% for 125,000 token, and a 1 million token, it scores 83.1.
And just so far ahead of everyone else.
It is miles ahead of everyone. The next nearest competitor is 64% on the 128K, and that's the GPT 4.5. Or none of the others have a 1 million context window result. And then multilingual performance. So This is really cool. Gemini scored an 89.8. None of the others have a result for this. So this is literally Gemini in real time translating language for a user based on, and we've seen it, you can do it in Google search. You can use Google Lens, point your phone at a sign that's written in an entirely different language, and it will actually overlay English on top of that sign so that you can read it. It is
very helpful.
It is really cool. For those who travel in foreign countries and don't speak the lingo.
Yeah. Well, I mean, especially if it's, say, not using Latin characters, right? That's gets where it gets a lot harder.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But yeah, look, it's the model has just gone from strength to strength. One of the really big things that Gemini 2.5 Pro ships with, like we all know the 1 million token context window, they are soon bringing that to 2 million.
Yeah, boy.
So
more context is better.
More billions.
Or more. Of course, your API calls are going to get more expensive with that. So well, just be, right. Be aware.
Yeah, 100% they will. But yeah, look, so we're going to go from 1 million token context window to 2 million token context window. With the sort of results that you're seeing here, this just leaves everything for dead. Across, like, as a generalization across the board, Gemini wins in most categories.
Yeah. Seeing how far it's come since Bard.
Yeah. Remember Bard, where it used to hallucinate something fierce? Yeah. I did a demo last year about creating a Slack bot that uses Gemini to answer questions. Super simple demo, like really simple bit of coding in Python to show the concepts and all that sort of stuff. But one of the things I did was I mistakenly used the wrong ID in the response from Slack. And so Gemini thought that it was me asking a question or responding, so it responded to that. So it was in an infinite loop of responding to itself, and this was like Gemini 1.0. It got so complimentary of itself. It was like, that's a fantastic answer, but you could improve on it by doing this. And then it'd respond to itself saying, oh, great, thanks for the suggestions. I've implemented that. What do you think about this? It just kept going. I've got 129-page PDF of Gemini talking to itself, and it gets weird.
Yeah. Running that experiment cost $68 million.
Yeah, it didn't. I got credits, but it can get expensive very quickly.
Very good.
Yeah.
Well, you know what, mate? I reckon that'll be the show for the fortnight.
I think so. We've run amok far too much here already.
We have. I reckon we managed to scrape something together there without Banky, but he can work his magic in post.
Yeah, that's it.
All right.
And he's got a lot of magic to work too.
Oh, he does. Well, he'll be all refreshed after his holiday.
That's right.
So, okay, everyone. So don't forget that you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube Music. And it would really help the show if you go on Apple Podcasts and write us a review. And why not smash that like button on our YouTube channel as well, right? If you want to reach out to us, you can email the show. That's contact@gcpbytes.com.au. Find us on the web, gcpbytes.com.au. And today's sponsors were Hive Tech Solutions, that's yours truly, and Mantle Group. I've talked enough for this fortnight, so anything else you want to add, Ian?
No, mate, have a great fortnight. We'll see you next time.
Bye. I've already done my script for the intro and outro stuff. I listened to Banky's one and I was like, all right, let's get all these beats there.
Welcome to GCP Bytes.
Bienvenidos.
And I'm your host, Troy McClure.
You might remember me for such podcasts.
Shows as...